From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio have catapulted into the national consciousness just how deadly the spread of online white nationalism, racist hatred, misogyny, and anti-immigrant sentiment is. President Donald Trump's scripted speech denouncing bigotry and white supremacy did little to distance himself from the supercharged spread of hate. Today, we'll examine the so-called alt-right and what underpins its dangerous ideology with my guest, Alexandra Minna Stern, professor of American culture, history, and women's studies at the University of Michigan, where she leads the Sterilization and Social Justice Lab. She is the award-winning author of Eugenic Nation, Faults and Frontiers of Better Breeding in Modern America, and Telling Genes, the Story of Genetic Counseling in America. She joins me to discuss her new book, Proud Boys and the White Ethno-State, how the alt-right is warping the American imagination. Welcome to the program, Alex.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So your book, of course, is extremely timely. The ideas that are growing or seem to be more and more popular among a certain segment of the American population are a little bit tucked away or brushed under the rug for the rest of us Americans. And of course, for your book, I imagine you had to delve deep into the ideology. How do you describe what it is that the alt-right actually believes in? Understanding that, of course, there are different groups and some overlapping agendas and some differences, but by and large, if you had to give a simple definition of what it is that they believe in, how would you describe it?
Yeah, well, the term alt-right, you know, I think is still a useful term because it encompasses this broad-based group of movements that are interconnected and ideologies. And I would describe it in a few ways. The first is stemming from cisgendered white male entitlement and a kind of aggrieved entitlement. A sense of deep existential dissatisfaction. But what links it together is basically, you know, the very ideas that you touched on as you introduced the program. You know, interwoven is racism, xenophobia, misogyny, transphobia, to a great extent, homophobia. These are exclusionary ideas about others and about fear of others, anxieties of others, and as well as, you know, underscored by a strong nostalgia for a white America that never was.
So this idea of whiteness is very much a part of of what it is that they're clinging to. And I'm wondering if we can just explore this for a little bit, because this is very much embedded in the history of America. There, this idea of America as a white nation, of European Americans thinking of themselves and calling themselves white, and then seeing that in contrast to the non-white America that just demographically, you know, because of changing demographics, began growing. It seems as though the social construct of whiteness is very much part of the framework of how we should view not just the alt-right, but their predecessors, right?
Indeed. I mean, I would say there's a few ways to think about this. The first is that, you know, as we know, this is a country that was built on white supremacy and has been challenged and changed in progressive and positive ways to, you know, in a number of good ways, but still has a long way to go and significant issues and structural inequalities. So that's one thing. But, you know, really what's happening today with the emergence and the resurgence of white nationalism is deep concern among these groups for demographic change. So if there's one thing that kind of ignites white nationalists today, it's, you know, looking at, you know, what ostensibly are census projections that by 2050 we will be in ethno-racial plurality in the United States, akin to the demographic changes that have happened in California and Texas. So really, you know, this idea of red pilling among white nationalists is based on this idea that whites will wake up and realize that, you know, whites should have an identity politics, they should protect their interests, they should protect their people, and that if they don't wake up and start doing so, that whites will become extinct as the country is, you know, invaded, and, you know, that's a word that's commonly used, invaded and taken over by racial others. So there's a kind of a deep anxiety brewing there. And, you know, the definition of whiteness is a question. On the one hand, you know, it is definitely rooted in a kind of genetic essentialism. You know, there have been stories of how white nationalists will use Ancestry.com or 23andMe to try to prove their European ancestry. But at the same time, there's a strong cultural element to it. So kind of, you know, if you feel white, you are white. I know you, you know me, this kind of like nod and wink aspect to it as well. So it's a little bit nebulous. It's hard to exactly pin down what whiteness is. And in fact, whiteness itself has been constructed through, you know, racialization. And so it's never been one thing or one stable thing. It's been part of a process of kind of racial formation in this country for centuries.
You used the term red pilling earlier. What does that mean?
Red pilling is, you know, one of these metaphors that is common among both the alt-right and the alt-light, which, and the alt-light tend to be social media celebrities who aren't quite willing to jump on the bandwagon of ethno-nationalism, but they have strong anti-leftist ideas, strong anti-feminist ideas. And red pilling is really the sense that, you know, if you swallow the red pill and wake up and see what has happened to American society has been led down.
This is a reference to The Matrix. So,
so you know that scene where, you know, Neo is offered the red pill or the blue pill and has to decide whether he, you know, basically wants to see the truth or, you know, to stay in, you know, kind of the brainwash system. And so seeking the truth, one realizes what bill of goods, you know, that's the idea with red pilling, whites or, you know, men who have been aggrieved by women who, you know, beta males or whatever, that's kind of the idea. So red pilling is really the sense of, you know, among white nationalists, let's, you know, get the normies or kind of the normal white people to our side. We can red pill them with these ideas about, you know, how misguided American society is, you know, where multiculturalism is taking American society and so on. So that's where that comes from. Now, you know, it is still, you can Google that term and you'll find it all over the place. And it's not only white nationalists who've used it, but it is one of definitely their go-to terms. And you will find people describing their own conversions in terms of having been red-pilled. They've added to that, you know, being white-pilled, which means that there's something positive. So, for example, when Trump says he's going to build the border wall, you know, that would be a white pill. And a black pill would be, you know, when they're, you know, the Democrats have some success or there's some other, you know, like when the women's soccer team won the World Cup, that would be, you know, definitely a black pill for them. Mm-hmm. So that kind of gives you the sense of how that metaphor works.
Wow. Now, let's talk about Trump specifically. There's this sense that, you know, Trump likes, or you get the sense that Trump thinks Americans are buying that there is a firewall between him and the alt-right and, you know, this very white supremacist infused culture. But of course, there isn't. He echoes their language and they echo it back to him and the rest of us. What did Trump's election mean to these movements? Because these movements predated Trump, and they seem to have, you know, been infused with new energy after he was elected, but he did not invent them or he did not create them.
They most certainly predate Trump. So let's say that, you know, someone else is elected to the White House, you know, next in 2020, you know, that doesn't mean this is not going to go away anytime soon. I mean, this is kind of the America that we're swimming in right now, and white nationalism is resurgent, and it's something that we, need to deal with systematically and, you know, really combat it and count and, you know, push against it. So that's one point. But in terms of Trump, I mean, I'd say there's a few things at play. First, you know, one of the things his election did was showed the power of a certain type of kind of, you know, social media meme making in helping push him over the top to be elected in 2016. And I think that actually, you know, those who supported him on what was then, you know, the loosely, you know, the emergent alt-right, they were as surprised as everyone else that he actually won the election by winning the Electoral College. And initially, you know, kind of the groups under this broad umbrella of the alt-right were ecstatic that he had been elected because they thought there would be a real opening and a real potential change in American society. They liked his, you know, kind of call outs of supposed political correctness and his, you know, authoritarian tendencies. But over time, over the past few years, what, you know, you do see if you study this is that white nationalists are generally dissatisfied with Trump. They feel like Trump has wimped out and just become another member of the Republican Party. But that doesn't mean that they don't like his ideas and that he doesn't. You know, it's kind of this reverberation effect. It's a reverberation and amplification and deflection. I mean, I think those are the three strategies that he kind of engages with in terms of the alt-right. He sometimes tweets them. He sometimes uses the language that I would say is the alt-right language that has crept into the mainstream. And sometimes he deflects them or tries to push back, but, you know, often in a kind of like, you know, a smoke and mirrors type of way. So you can never quite tell exactly what's going on. So these days, I would say that, you know, there are different facets of white nationalism. There are those who are, you know, pleased with what has happened in El Paso and feel like, you know, a racial war, you know, a violent racial war is needed. But there are many others who actually hope to take a more more streamlined approach and are wary of that because they think someone like the El Paso shooter has given white nationalism a bad name and they want to have a kind of a more policy-oriented approach to it. That's very interesting, and that's something we'd have to spend some more time unpacking. So it depends on, you know, I would say that the white nationalist approach to Trump is both, you know, clapping and applauding when he does things that are in step with kind of their talking points, but also dissatisfaction, because you have to remember that term alternative comes from rejecting both the Republican and the Democratic Party and any other party, you know, the Green Party, the, you know, the Socialist Party, whatever other party, and wanting to, you know, kind of find a third way. And that's where we also, the alt-right rubs up into kind of neo-fascism, both in the United States and, you know, its kind of sister organizations do the same in Europe.
Now, let's talk about the role of white women. The, you know, misogyny is very much an underpinning of these alt-right groups. Some of the men who have ended up, you know, taking a number of lives through mass shootings have often been found to have posted misogynist views online. And yet a large number of white women supported Trump, at least in 2016. We'll see what happens in 2020. But how do white women square their support for someone like Trump, even as the alt-right part of his base is so overtly misogynist?
Well, I think that there are, you know, a good number of white women who believe that, you know, patriarchy is the best option for them because it provides protection, it provides security, and it is very much infused with this kind of nostalgia for, you know, American society in the 1950s or 1960s. So it really is kind of a romanticized version of what was. The underbelly of that we know is, you know, segregation, racial violence, exclusion, you know, a whole range of other ugly attributes of American society. But I also think that, you know, it's interesting, there's a survey researcher who looked at some of the key beliefs that are associated with white nationalism, and those are a need to protect European heritage in America. The idea that whites are being victimized, and attacked, as well as the idea that diversity is bad for the United States, because it hinders white people. And some of the survey results that have come out from that work have shown that, in terms of whites who uphold that, women have a slight edge over men in terms of endorsing such ideas.
Wow.
So I think that even though, yeah, I know it's quite telling. So it's there. One wonders how much of a kind of, a silent white majority this is. And if you look at organizations such as the American Identity Movement or some of the other actual organizations that have meetings that are, put their face out there, on social media and speak for white nationalism, they're overwhelmingly white men. And these events have, maybe three or four women will take part. But nonetheless, there is a whole facet of the movement that is made up of white women who often are, making vlogs from home. They use their domestic space to reach out and connect with each other and to build community, both virtually and in person. So I definitely think that we shouldn't discount the role and the potential influence of white women in white nationalism today.
Now, what about how these groups are warping the American imagination, to quote your subtitle? Let's talk about the fact that there are white Americans who call themselves conservative, who would completely deny that they are racist, who say that on paper they love the idea of multiculturalism and immigrants are great as long as they, get in line. That's a favorite refrain. They're happy because Trump is doing something about all the lawbreakers. And they really deny that there is any, desire for a white state, but still back a lot of Trump's policies. How has our politics gotten warped by the ideas of the alt-right so that there exists this white America that can support Trump and still claim to be non-racist? And I don't say anti-racist, but non-racist.
Well, to start, white supremacy is so deeply entrenched in American society that to, overcome it, to extirpate it, to change American society requires, a great deal of reckoning and, calling things out and taking them head on. If you don't do that, things often return to kind of the default position, and the way they have been. And so that's where progressive politics comes in terms of calling that out and working towards change and those types of commitments. So I would say, what I meant with the title was really to look at the ways in which these ideas and the language that have been, the language and the memes, and I think meme making is an important part of this, have seeped into the way in which certain issues are framed. And those can be issues like immigration. So right now, in light of what happened in El Paso with the massacre, in light of what's going on with detention and family separation, there's been some pushback in the liberal and left media around the word invasion. That word is really important to take apart, and that word has been used in the U.S. and also quite extensively in Europe with regard to, xenophobia and anti-refugee ideas and policies. So that's what, in the title, I think it's really important to look at language and the way that language has been affected by the upsurge of white nationalism and by the kind of amplification and refraction that Trump is engaging in when he tweets, when he talks, when he's at his rallies. And I think that is doing great danger because it changes the way, the possibilities for how we frame understandings of things. And, these ideas can seep into the, kind of what we might call the mainstream. I'd also like to add to that point that it's really important, we've folks have talked about 8chan in the context of the El Paso shooter and the Christchurch shooter. And
yeah, the online
yes,
8chan,
forum. Exactly, the online message forum, which is what, you know, when 4chan was shut down because of Gamergate, was the Gamergate protagonists were thrown out of it, they went to 8chan. But, you know, 8chan, in a way, yes, it's a problem. Yes, it is extreme. But it is also, you know, in many ways, just an exaggeration of what's already going on in corridors of Twitter, on Facebook, and on other social media platforms. So I think it's really, we have to be careful, you know, we shouldn't just call it an aberration. We should look at how have language and politics and the contours of what can be said and how things are being framed, how have they changed? And I really think we need to get a handle on these words, understand them, and in some instances, you know, kind of like take them back and reframe them.
So a big part of this conversation is, of course, the creation and spread of fake news propaganda, and a lot of it happens these days, as you were suggesting, through memes. There was a story earlier this year about a Louisiana cop who wanted to shoot Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or sort of fantasized about shooting her, underneath a meme of her that suggested that she had voted to reduce the salaries of soldiers or something like that, which was not true. And so it's become so easy to just make wild claims, spew lies, put them on an image, and create suggestive ideas, and then spread them really easily and make them these shareable links. How critical is the role of these memes? And do you have any opinion on whether Russia is behind it all? Because we've, you know, heard a lot of news coverage of how the Russian government is interested in seeing a polarization of the American electorate, and others have dismissed that as total conspiracy theory.
I don't have much expertise on, you know, kind of the reach of Russia in this instance. I would say that, you know, let's just take Russia out of it. Let's say we don't even need Russia to be part of this equation to understand what's going on with fake news and meme making. I mean, that is, you know, think of something like the conspiracy theory like Pizzagate or similar conspiracy theories that suggest that Democrats are running, like, you know, pedophilia rings, and in addition to, you know, the existence of a deep state, you know, in the American government. So these ideas are very appealing to some. They tap into kind of this long history of conspiracy thinking and paranoia in American society. And I would say, you know, we all need to have much better social media literacy for a whole range of reasons. But one of them is to understand what's going on with, you know, things like deep fakes. You know, where basically, you know, CGI and other technologies are used to, you know, present people as if they were saying certain things. I think that's been done with Nancy Pelosi and a few others.
Digital manipulation of video. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. And so I think that that's really important. But it's also important, you know, there's still, it's challenging because, you know, as journalists want to, you know, show the truth to, you know, there still is that search for, you know, clearing up misconceptions, looking for the objective facts and clarifying them. So I always think of the Washington Post, which has this running list of lies that Trump has told. And the list is, you know, I don't know, in the hundreds, if not thousands now. But is that, and I think that's important that they do that, but how, to what extent is that really going to help us navigate this new social media ecosystem, you know, where a lot of politics and kind of like cultural conflict is playing out. So one of the things I learned from writing this book was I dove deep into digital studies, understanding better social media, and really trying to think about the power of social media without overstating it in the ways in which kind of framing of ideas and, you know, memes and images, just the powerful role it plays.
So finally, I'm wondering, Alex, if you can give us a sense of where you think this is headed in 2020. There's this fear that if Trump is not reelected, that not only would he sort of refuse to leave office, but there would be this uprising among these groups because they're getting bolder, they're getting angrier, they're spreading their hate. I know it's always tricky to ask folks to speculate or try to predict the future, but what do you fear, having delved so deep into this movement, this underground movement, what do you fear for the next couple of years?
Well, I guess a few things. The first is that, you know, some people have suggested that this is, you know, the last gasp of kind of, you know, a minority of white Americans, you know, trying to hang on to power and control. I view it more as it's going to be a long, drawn out, raspy breath. You know, I don't think it's going away anytime soon. You know, it's hard for me to, you know, I can't predict what's going to happen. Unfortunately, you know, what happened in El Paso happened before, and we certainly hope that that will never happen again. But, you know, the environment out there with the access to military assault rifles and, you know, this kind of copycatting of manifestos, you know, who would not be concerned about that going forward? But I would say that, you know, you mentioned that this is, you know, kind of underground groups. And yes, there is a way in which these groups, particularly the most extreme, you know, they are, you know, existing on, you know, kind of fringes of society that most of us are not going into. We're not going into, you know, the darker corners of 8chan to see what their ideas are. But, you know, I'm also just generally more concerned about the ways in which these ideas have seeped more broadly into kind of mainstream thinking in society. Hmm. So it's not just like we have to combat what's on the fringe and then all will be well. I mean, I think we really have to look closely at how has American, you know, society, language, and culture shifted over the past 3 to 4 years. We're in very different terrain now than we were, you know, in 2015, 2016. And, you know, in a context in which authoritarianism and populist nationalism is on the rise around the globe in countries ranging from, you know, Hungary to Italy and a range of other places. So I really think we just, you know, we need to look deeply and be really critical, you know, of from the mainstream all the way to, you know, the far right.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Alex. Good luck with the book. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Take care.
My guest has been Alexandra Minna Stern, professor of American culture, history, and women's studies at the University of Michigan. And we've been discussing her new book, Proud Boys and the White Ethno-State, How the Alt-Right is Warping the American Imagination. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.